just for people's time.
Okay, while we're waiting for Mr. Kane, we're going to start the meeting, and Joe has asked me to convene the meeting until Mr. Kane gets here. So with that, we'll start. My name is George Kapatis. I'm the commissioner here at Employment Security, and I'll be chairing the meeting until Mr. Kane makes the meeting. Please state your name. So that the transcription service can accurately document today's meeting. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board. It's open to the public. Will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91-A. Meeting materials for the board or the public can be found by visiting New Hampshire Works webpage. We have a number of items to work through today. You'll find these items on the agenda with their enclosed supportive documents. The agenda and these documents have been provided to the board electronically. Last week, printed copies are available today, and all materials will be made available to the public via the New Hampshire Works website. Joe, would you please call the roll for the meeting?
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to start alphabetically. Mike Alberts.
Here.
Thank you. Jim Alden.
Here.
Thank you. Joseph Alexander.
Here.
Thank you. Kevin Avard. Rick Bartle. Christine Brennan. Joe Brown.
Yes, here.
Thank you. Anya Brzezinski. Kelly Clark. Kenneth Clinton.
Here.
Thank you. George Kapatis.
Here.
Thank you. Adam Crapo.
Here.
Thank you. Bruce Crocheter.
Here.
Thank you. Mary Crowley. Tyler Eaton. Patrick Fall.
Here.
Thank you. George Hansel. Cindy Harrington.
Here.
Thank you. John Hennessy.
Here.
Thank you. Candace Hyde.
Present.
Thank you. Michael Kane. Mr. Kane is just running a few minutes late. Justin Cantor.
Here.
Thank you. Shane Long.
Here.
Thank you. Donnelly Lozo.
Here.
Thank you. Lori-Ann Lundgren.
Here.
Thank you. Larry Major. Ashok Patel. Jim Prue. Shannon Reed.
Here.
Thank you. Tim Sink. Gary Thomas.
Here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, with the roll call complete, we have a quorum.
Great. Okay. We're going to move on. Everybody received the meeting minutes from the June meeting, and they're found in your packet. I'm assuming you've had a chance to review the minutes. Are there any errors, corrections, or omissions? If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Move. Second.
Second.
All those.
Oh. Yes. Donnelly Lozo.
Okay. Motion made. Second. All those in favor? Opposed? Motion carries. Okay. I would like to welcome everybody here today. Again, my name is George Kapatis. It's great to see you here today. I appreciate you all being here. And I know everyone's schedules are busy. We'll have a full agenda and a lot of information to cover, so let's get started. We'd like to take a moment and see if anybody from the public would like to provide any public comment. If so, please state your name for the record prior to speaking. Okay. We have several informational items in your packet. We start the agenda with some informational items. There are reports and updates provided to the board. These do not require a vote. However, if board members would like to make motions, I would ask that you please wait until the next section on our agenda. Please remember before speaking to state your name for the recording. Joe, could you guide us through those items, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Item 2A is conversation with John Reese, and I'm going to kick it over to our colleague, Donnelly Lozo, for introductions and kind of to kick this off.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. We wanted to bring to your attention some tools that we've been trying to implement together in the state My agency, Southern New Hampshire Services, actually administers the WIOA adult program, and we do a fair amount of work with the state. As a community action agency, we serve people of low income to help them get employed, be able to cover the costs of, you know, whatever they're faced with that prevents them from economic stability and social mobility. And so we have been working together in the state with an initiative called New Hampshire Jobs, Parents Working, Children Thriving for probably 4 or 5 years now. It's an initiative that's in all 50 states. Each state has a chapter. In New Hampshire, I co-chair that chapter with Kim Runyon, who's over there against the wall. She could wave. And out of some of that work, collectively, House Bill 4 in 2021 was an early result of that work that we've been doing, which is a white paper was designed to talk about the cliff effect, which I know that we've talked about in this room before, where people are less inclined to take a promotion or a pay raise because then their benefits that they may be receiving will be such a loss that they won't recover from it. And so the work was meant to design an opportunity to provide a path for people to see how they could accept some of those things, get credentials, go back to school, do all of those things, and still maintain, you know, their family income such that they didn't have a negative impact. Sitting to my left is Associate Commissioner Christine Santinello from DHHS, who I co-chaired the Cliff Effect work with as a result of House Bill 4 with the committee. From that, a lot of work has been done that has laid out how we might approach some of those cliffs that we've talked about. But in order to do that work, we need some tools, as you can appreciate. Something visually, something that can calculate things for real data. And so we were selected by Manhattan Strategies Group to be one of three states that they would develop at no cost a cliff calculator. And so that we've been working on that for almost 2 years now. And each time we're ready to launch, we find the benefits changed or something happened. The first time we went to launch, they didn't realize that they should have a mobile app. And we're thinking, well, a lot of the staff and others that we work with, travel and meet with people, really need something that can be done that way. So we've now been training the staff, both at DHHS and at our agency, to learn how to use that tool when they're working with the folks that we serve. And as that initiative is unrolling, the Atlanta Fed has also been working on these same issues and designed a career ladder, which I think they're now calling a dashboard. That's a tool that you can actually sit with somebody and have them see what happens if you work at Dunkin' Donuts versus become an RN, and where are the points and the changes that the state have made, where's that spot that you can stay safe. So that's the second tool. And then the third tool is a tool that the Boston Fed has been designing, which will be most important, I think, to many of you around the table, which we call the employer tool, which will allow an employer to see, if you make a decision about Donna Lee, giving her a promotion, you can go in and see, will that hurt her? Will she lose some of these other benefits that she needs, her child care scholarship, her TANF that has maybe a year left on it, those sorts of things. So joining us today is John Reese from the Atlanta Fed, who's going to walk you through the career ladder tool, and then he'll make mention of the employer tool, which we hope to bring to you at some point soon that you'll be able to look at and learn how to use. And the Associate Commissioner, if you wanted to add anything?
Of course, because I said I'm not going to say anything, but I always do. So it was like I can never. And I think Rich Labors and I presented to this group probably like a couple years ago, because prior to us working on developing a strategy, we actually did a pretty comprehensive economic analysis through New Hampshire Employment Security, and we surveyed 40 different communities in the state, and we looked at business climate, social vulnerability index, as well as benefits, to really understand What is the point for the individuals and families in our communities? And from that, we developed some recommendations on ways that we could mitigate the cliff effect so that maybe we have an off-ramp instead of a cliff. And right now, the department is working on a number of strategies to help us help families and really focus on the workforce, because many of the participants that receive either SNAP or TANF want to be working, could be working. We just have to figure out the sweet spot there, and this is really meant to help us do that.
So. Speaking of data, that was an important point that I should have made.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. With that, John?
Thanks so much. Good evening, everyone. My name is John Priest, senior advisor at the Atlanta Fed, to give you a walkthrough to this benefits cliff issue and highlight some tools that we have been developing. So again, I'm from the Atlanta Fed's Advancing Careers for Low-Income Families Initiative, which is fundamentally looking at how do we increase economic mobility among low-income families, how do we identify disincentives to work, and how to develop tools that help people better understand that, make better decisions, and ultimately try to partner with organizations, workforce development boards, states, on developing and identifying mitigation strategies across a lot of these issues. So you've all heard it before. I never know how many people are familiar with this issue. Some people are intimately familiar with the issue of benefits, with other people less so. But it really is the idea that you take a modest increase in salary, whether that's from a raise or taking on additional hours at work, any gains that you receive in income are more than offset by the loss of public benefits assistance. And it can be a really disincentive to work. And I think we often conceptualize this as being something that really threatens individual workers, though I would argue that it also impacts employers and governments pretty significantly. It often may seem like a niche area of concern, but in Alabama, for example, last year, the state surveyed workers, and 37% of workers said they had turned down a job, a promotion, or additional hours because of the fear that they would lose government benefits. In Florida, we had the Florida Chamber of Commerce ask this question to employers, quite as high, but a pretty still substantial number of companies, a third of companies said that they had workers turn down a job or a wage increase because of this fear. I think it speaks to a couple things. One is there are real cliffs, right? That you can get a dollar wage and then lose $5,000 in benefits. I think the other problem often is that workers don't know exactly where that lift is, and so they may actually be able to work more hours or take that raise, but because they don't exactly know where that is, and it's a lot, I take an extra shift this week and I lose my hours or whatever, or I lose my benefits, it's going to take me a lot longer to get back on. And so just being able to, I think, more precisely identify where that cliff is can be helpful, even if a worker isn't going to run into the cliff. And from the government side, I mean, ultimately, I think one of the issues around benefits cliff is it's a short-term disincentive, but generally speaking, over the long term, workers are better off. As we'll see, it may take many, many years, but if we can support people through their career trajectory, the benefit and the sort of dividends paid to governments is pretty significant. If a typical worker switches from a near minimum wage job to an LPN in Concord over their lifetime, assuming they're about 25 years old, that's over $200,000 in savings. So again, the benefits cliff issue sort of affects everybody. It was pretty pervasive. Now, I am very new to this. I started in May, and my background is in economic development. Consulting, which I've been doing for about 15 or so years. And I think one of the reasons I was attracted to this issue is because of how well it dovetails with one of probably the biggest issue right now in economic development, which is desire for more talent. Right? No matter where you're going, you've got an incredibly tight labor market. And here, you all are no exception. And that's wild, like a 2%. Unemployment rate. I remember when everybody said 5% is unemployment, and we keep going lower and lower. Labor force participation is also near historic lows, right? at least since Rutgers has been keeping, 45 years ago, this is about as low as it's ever been. And workers themselves are actually saying they want to work fewer hours. And so I think there's not a better time than to try to remove some of these disincentives for work, workers, but it would also benefit employers as well. So around this issue of benefits, we've developed a series of tools. And as analysts, we're going to keep changing the names. One thing that the Fed is not good at is branding. But that's not our strongest suit. So I think these are going to be the names for a while. But with the dashboard, the planner, the employer edition, and the snapshot. The snapshot and employer edition are kind of sort of near images of each other. It shows you sort of a point in time change, and I'll show you some examples later. If you go from $13 an hour to $14 an hour, what does this mean for you? If you go from 30 hours a week to 40 hours a week, what does that mean? Again, sort of one is worker-facing and one is employer-facing. We also have the Cliff dashboard, which integrates that dynamic within a broader context of choosing a career. And I'm going to walk you through an example of that momentarily. And then a Cliff planner provides a little bit more granularity, increases the overall accuracy, but it's also going to get more time-consuming to But our hope is that we ultimately have a tool for sort of every So again, I'm going to talk about the dashboard, which primarily has four inputs. The first one being your location, because ultimately that often drives both the overall cost, which we calculate within our overall cost of living. And obviously, if you live in Concord, you're going to have a different cost of living than if you're in Manchester, if you're in Boston. It also helps identify what are the benefits that you're probably eligible for. So again, the first part is the overall geographic characteristics of the worker. The second thing is the household demographic. Just like cost of living and benefits, a lot of that is ultimately driven by your household composition. So this example, we have one adult, I don't know if everybody can read that, we're putting in there 25, with two kids, ages 5 and 10. The next thing he's going to ask you for is public assistance. And a lot of these questions in the employer tool will be what you would see as well. What you would not see is this last part, but everything else would be included. For public assistance, you have three options. You say all, which is possible but very uncommon. Choose none, you might ask why would we do none, and that is if you just want to see the overall wage trajectories of two different careers, regardless of whether the public benefit is. And then the third option, which is the one I'm going to show you today, you can actually select whatever public benefit that is. This example is grant 4, Section 8, child care subsidy, EITC, and a couple others, CHIP. And then finally, again, this is for the status board, what is that career pathway that you're interested in pursuing? For today's example, we're going to do an LPN, licensed practical nurse. The final question is asking, how long are you going to be in school? You can select just typical education requirements of that position. You could also, if you have, you have a specific accelerated program that you know locally, you can that in. Here, it's going to compare this to what we call a near minimum wage job, which is basically a cashier, and all the subsequent charts you're going to see are based on the median wage of that cashier position in your local community. And once you've done all this, you need to calculate results, and it's going to spit out a bunch of charts that hopefully everybody can understand, but not here to explain them today. This is going to be the top line figure. That dark bar shows the overall anticipated income for that LPN position compared to that near minimum wage job, which is sort of that marigold color. And that gray dotted line is what we are calling the self-sufficiency target. So again, we've got one worker, two kids. That first year, we anticipate self-sufficiency target about $45,000. That encompasses all anticipated expenses for that household, whether it's childcare, housing, utilities, everything. And I think this is, I think, historically, how we've seen this, we're saying, all right, this is why you should go back to school, because this is immediate payoff, or almost immediate. In our model, we have a one-year time period in which you're not better off because we assume you're in school, you're getting your education, and you're actually working a near minimum wage job, like part-time, while you're in school. Once that's complete, though, I think, again, historically, we've said, all right, you're much better off. You're making close to a little over $40,000 compared to that near minimum wage worker making $20,000. So you doubled your wage. Why aren't more people pursuing this? But what this does not encapsulate what we call annual net financial resources, which is not only that wage, that income that you're earning from your job, but also public assistance, less expenses, and minus taxes. And once you integrate that, it becomes a lot more complicated. So for these two examples, on the left is that LPN position, to the right is that near minimum wage occupation. And remember, for the individual in that LPN position that first year, they're not even 20, they'll take some time, you get a lot of benefits, but then it pretty sharply declines. Whereas next cashier is getting a pretty significant amount of public assistance, basically for 10 to 20 years. And once you integrate that, you get a much different picture, right? You're still better off in that LPN position, but it's not nearly as much as you think. You actually hit a cliff your basically third year, whereas you get a raise, you lose more benefits than you saw the increase in wage. And then you, after that, you get a little bit of a bump, let's say, up here, and then you're treading water for 5 or 6 years. And then you end up having another bump, and then you're treading water. And a lot of times those bumps, basically your kid got so old that they no longer need daycare. That's the only reason you're seeing material increase in your living. Again, this is just one example, but I think it shows how complicated this can be. Just because, again, a worker receives an increase, they may not be materially better off. Again, and so that early period here, I don't know about you all, but particularly in, you know, with inflation as it is, like, this is a pretty long period of time where they're seeing no increase, right? 5 or 6 years. And they've already had to go through that 1 year of school where they were significantly worse off. And so I think helping people understand, trying to figure out ways where there's a change in policy. We've also worked with some organizations that are looking to see if it's possible to backfill those gaps, right? Provide wraparound services. So there is that smooth transition, because again, it is a the planner, again, if you choose what I have to do, what I just showed, it will impute everything based on local patterns, like housing, childcare, whatnot. The planner would allow you to actually talk with the worker and calculate those costs specifically. That's actually also available in this employer tool, where you can drill down and really get a sense of what the actual cost of living. This is the employer tool. We've tried to simplify it as much as possible. We're really just looking at hourly wages and hours worked. Do you have a cash bonus and is there any kind of stipend? This will help you sort of identify where those puts might be. You know, is it possible to restructure your compensation packages? We are not sort of tax experts, but you can imagine maybe, you know, just giving someone a transportation stipend, something like that, which might not be taxable. That might be worth more to a worker than a dollar increase because it's not going to set off that cliff. Again, we are actually still tweaking this because it's a very complicated issue and we want to get it right. But again, our hope is that employers are actually doing a pilot right now with a large healthcare system to sort of see how they can implement this tool. Because it's not only sort of a compensation strategy, but maybe it's identifying career pathways. That LPN job isn't a huge payout immediately, but if we can combine that with additional schooling over time and an RN, if you actually do that calculation, it's a massive payout. And so maybe it's identifying career pathways that empower workers. So again, we still have a lot of potential applications. We've worked most extensively with workforce organizations, but I think for this to gain traction, we also need to make better relationships and improve our relationships with employers like yourselves. So again, that's sort of the fast and furious. I think we've got a lot of items on your agenda.
We have time for questions.
All right. Any questions? That was so fast.
And again,
how many of you have like heard of this? Because like, I don't know the French, for example. Turns out his father was like one of the first franchisees of Pizza Hut in Arizona. So he got me. And he, when I told him I was organizing, he's like, "Oh, I was always hearing that about my work, but I didn't believe it. I walked through this." And he thought it was like just a total misconception that workers didn't understand the program or whatnot. That's why they came down. I was like, "No, there, you can lose significant amounts of money." Have you all heard of this with your workers?
Yes.
Yes.
Has it gotten better or has it gotten worse? Or is it the same? Is it a little bit more serious?
Probably about the same.
Weird.
I would say the same.
did you all believe it? 24% is like, oh, surely it's not that big. Or did you not know?
Didn't know.
So, yeah, I mean, that is hopefully one of the uses of the tool is to walk employers through it. So, to say, all right, again, you know, maybe there's no point. We're actually working with a nonprofit of care providers. We've been advocating for wage increases, and one thing we're interested in is, does the wage increase actually meaningful change? You can run some of these scenarios, and it's like, well, the worker makes $2,000 more a year by adding a dollar wage, but they're going to lose $1,900 of benefits. Is there really much of a thing now? Is that? And so the employer's asking is, why am I getting more job applicants? Why am I increasing my wages to attract more people, but it's not functionally leading to material benefit for the worker?
Shannon? Do you have something on?
Hi, John. I'm Shannon Reed with the Community College System of New Hampshire. On the part of the dashboard where it, one of the inputs is forms of public assistance, are educational benefits at all in that mix, such as FAFSA, Pell eligibility and eligibility for other types of need-based post-secondary aid?
No. That's not normal. The reason we act, we do not actually. I think it's about 12 or 14, and I'd be happy to send a list of the benefits that are in there. Public assistance is not. I'm sorry, health grants are not. Education assistance are not. We kind of constantly go back and forth about, like, can we add everything or not? But I'd be happy to talk to you to see if it is possible.
It's an interesting point, Al, right? Because, Don Lee Lozo.
Sorry.
Wow. I couldn't imagine that. If we have somebody on the trajectory that we want them on, where they're going back to, you know, school, or they're getting in there, if they could lose the ability to get that tuition assistance, that's, I think, a critical component of the discussion here that we should look at and understand better. What can we do about that? Because when the state can say, well, we'll do a 50% disregard on TANF, so they'll still get at least half while they're getting to that point where they're self-sufficient, I don't know that this, you know, we can get the feds to say, oh, and you can still have your Pell grant. So that's, I think, probably a very worthwhile follow-up.
Percent or other. I think an other would be really important, because it wouldn't be a lot of people, you know, so something like that could be plugged in, especially on the, when you're sitting trying to figure out the trajectory for somebody, because it's the, what are the short, what's the short term, how do we compensate the short term for the long term gain? One of the things we are piloting, and I'm glad you're here, at the department is right now, our TANF disregard is 50%, but we're doing a pilot to, if you are receiving TANF, which is temporary assistance for needy families, they really have to change that name. And you take a job, which is a high demand job, which pretty much anything right now could be considered a high demand job, will allow for 2 years 100% disregard, so that it really incentivizes people to go to work. And then if you have TANF, you're eligible for TANF, you remain eligible for SNAP, you remain eligible for Medicaid. So Kim's team is really working on a lot of those pieces to try to, let's test some things to see what works.
It should be very powerful, right? And that's, I think, something that we sort of focus on in the sense of, you know, part of the problem is, like, what if you, again, so many of these workers are hourly workers, you know, are above the eligibility threshold for a brief period of time, let's say, you know, working over in the retail store for Christmas or whatever, you know. And then something happens, or you can't take on as many hours, but you've already exited out. So having that continuous eligibility can help people, you know, work as much as they want without worrying about that. Yes, sir.
Patrick Fall. Now, this might be an odd question, but what are we considering retirees? People on Social Security, because I've heard people say they would work more, but if they go to their Social Security, I know they're retired, it kind of, you know, goes against the idea of retirement, because some people realize retirement isn't all it's cracked up to be, but they want to keep their Social Security because they worked for it their whole life, and now they want to actually work again, but then that's going to get taken away.
I thought your eligibility depended on when you started receiving it, but once you started it.
No, they can't take it, Donnelly Lozo. They can't take it away. You just have to pay tax on the amount that's above what they allow.
That's where it is, okay.
Do you know what that is?
I want to say it's either 13 or 17,000, one of those numbers.
And that brings up another point. When we talk about those plateaus are also an issue in that sense, right? They're not included because it's just a straight percentage. But it is essentially this incentive. And there are, I can't remember what the last county was, and there's basically millions of workers in this state from before the pandemic. Some of it is vulnerable workers. It's a lot of it. I mean, walking around here, I got here last night, probably looks like everywhere else right now, you just walk around the top one signs everywhere. A lot of those jobs are public facing, which if you're older in a pandemic, you're not being charged with social security. Is everybody feeling that like 2% unemployment rate right now? That, I will say that is acceptable. Like, it's low everywhere, but that is exceptionally low.
Do you expect that to change anytime soon?
I don't know. Oh, I should also say, don't do the Fed. Anything I said like, is my opinion. The Fed, like, you have to say that, not necessarily reflecting the views of the Fed. I mean, it's hard to see it getting any tighter, right? 2%. But I think, again, putting my hat on economic development, I do think one of the issues is just here is a. You're not growing as fast as, let's say, like a Texas or a Georgia where I live now, but that means you're not attracting as many like new residents. And that does make it a challenge, right? There's just not this influx of, you know, in Austin, it's, what do they say? It's like 1,000 people a week moving in. Like, you don't have that with the eval that a lot of, like, so many communities have. So even if you're not, if you're growing at a moderate pace, it is harder to fill those gaps. And your population is slightly older. Billy Hart has been said for a variety of reasons. So.
Jim Alden, you're calculating the unemployment rate at 2%, but with the participation rate at such a low level, have you done any calculations on what the unemployment rate would be if we had a somewhat more historically consistent participation rate?
That's a good question. No, I mean, that is a very frustration, right? If you're not actually looking for a job, you're not counted. And there's, again, if you're, I think that older population is part of it, right? If you said, you know what, until this, like, who knows if there's going to be another, you know, Omicron thing or experience, you know, I'm not going, my like, this thing's totally over and done with. It's also not clear, again, like, I'm curious if the Ben were, I'm, the data trails a little bit, but this is just because actually become a bigger deal. Because there's certain sort of wage bands where it becomes a really big issue to your children. And a lot of it depends on your household composition, it depends on where you live. But it's often in that, let's say, $17 to $22 an hour range. And as we've seen a lot of raises, is that becoming a more prominent issue? Because you're just, at least, again, not just in Florida, but in Texas, fast food places are paying $16. That was unheard of like 2 or 3 years ago, which starts putting you increasingly at that this cliff. And you know, there's also talk that like you know, the number of people who have long COVID is not insignificant, right? That is totally to millions of people that may not be fully participating. You know, people just like we are in a country that we were 3 or 4 years ago. So like, some of this got, I think, like a lot of things are in the pandemic, right? It accelerated some existing trends, one of which was getting older. And one of those, if you look at that, the report participation, it's been falling for quite a while, right? So,
do you think this recession, what's the Fed's position on employment after, once the recession really kicks in?
I mean, I think, and again, this is just me. So.
Yeah.
But I think the Fed's been pretty clear that their primary concern is inflation.
Yeah.
Job loss, that would be a fortunate job, but you've got to tame inflation. And I mean, again, it is like 2%, it is a very weird, like 2% unemployment isn't great for anybody. I guess great for work, but it's not the norm, right?
No. No, it's not the norm.
So we will see it. You know, I didn't think it would get, you know, if you told anybody, I think 2 years ago, you'd be so much of a disappointment. It's been a really weird couple of years. But again, hopefully, I think obviously people focus on inflation, because that's the most prominent thing the Fed does. But our other mandate is maximum employment. And I think regardless of whether, you know, it's more acute now, but this is a disincentive. So if we can highlight this and identify either sort of mitigation strategies, changes in policy, or anything else to sort of address this, because again, I think it does, you know, you can be a pretty rational worker and say it's not worth taking on this job or these hours, because I really think, something like particularly child care, you know, if I lose that, child care is so much more expensive than pension plan at all, right? That's such an anchor service for everything else, which is another, actually, I think another reason you might see lower participation. Having just moved from Texas to Georgia, I cannot tell you how unbelievably difficult it was to secure child care. And I was fortunate to pay for it more than some people, right? And it's still, and it took me so long in my life to really did want to work, but you know, we called 27 places, and 26 had wait lists between 6 months and 1.5 months.
I'm Shannon Reed again. Are there places where this kind of counseling, you know, cliff counseling, is more or less fully implemented, and have you seen a difference? Has it moved the needle, or has it resulted in some types of some of the policy changes that Chris is talking about in terms of benefit forgiveness or continuation? Are there places where this kind of tool has actually made a difference?
So there's three places. I guess I'll briefly talk about. One is we've piloted this in many places. The initial pilots have not resulted in a change of policy. We interviewed. They were deployed along career approaches, and they asked basically the participants what they thought of this, and it was generally very positive. Even if they couldn't avoid the cliff and there was no policy for mitigating it, one, knowing about it, so, and some people will say, you know what, I don't care, I want a job, right? And some people, knowing where that line was helpful. Like in general, I think it was about 75-80% of people said it was very helpful. It was also, the pilot we did was with this career tool. It helped them understand like what the implications of a new career were, which they found helpful. Interestingly, and this was not, I think, the primary audience we initially envisioned, some places deployed it to high school students, and so the new career part was actually very helpful, because I would put myself in this boat. Those 16 to 18 year olds did not have much of an idea of how expensive it is to live a life with kids. And it's very illuminating to sort of say, okay, I need like $45,000 just to kind of break even here, is helpful. We've also worked with a couple, so there's basically been a flood that's sort of outside my personal opinion, but there are some guaranteed income programs that have been audited throughout the country. We've used our tool because theoretically, right, if you're giving someone a cash grant, it's in $500 a month, that's what these guaranteed income programs are doing. They could potentially lose other benefits. And so we've seen, I think Washington, D.C. is looking at how they can change some of their policies so that they can minimize the cliff. And then the third area is in Tennessee, for example, there is an organization that actually took all of our raw data, but their own tools, again, it's like, they're the ones that are, they've got grant funding to try to fill these. Like, if you hit the cliff and you lose that $6,000 over a year, we're going to give you $500 a month to pay for child care. So that's the one place I know where they're literally trying. Like when that cliff happens, they will try to make you whole. But that's private dollars. For one of the reasons that a lady alluded to earlier is that for some of these programs, even if you identify the issue, there are federal limits on your flexibility, right? You can't just make a decision on them to change the rules. And so that's where things like nonprofits, things like where employers come in handy, okay, are there other strategies? Given that we don't have ultimate flexibility in the administration of some of these programs.
And Chris Santinella. When we were working on developing kind of our recommendations and strategies to test for the cliff effect, I think what was really important is we had parents at the table who really had gone through the benefits and said this is where it really was a pain point for me, and we really tried to adapt some of those things. And then through lots of discussion with staff, we were like, oh, if we do this, you know, and, you know, surveying my eligibility workers to say, where do you see where people really start to fall? And there was one thing with our, I think, Pim, was it the TANF child care deduction? It didn't make sense. And we're like, okay, so let's see if we can make a difference. And so we're starting small with a really small number of people, but we're really trying to study the impact on those folks to see what we can be doing permanently.
Don Lelozo again. I just want to say that I think one of the most important things, and you'll know this as employers, is you just can't treat everybody the same, right? So we have to look at people where they are as individuals and what their barriers may be, and then bring to the table the tools to help them, you know, have some sense that they can control their own destiny. And that's, these tools are meant to do that. And Shannon, I don't think there's been any great big studies about it, but I can tell you that our staff, like Kim's, that work with people for career training and the work that Matt Russell does, you know, with the WIOA program, when a staff person can sit with somebody and walk them through some of these different things, it makes a huge difference to whether they believe they can succeed. And that's, you know, really the crux of the work.
Can I ask a question? How many of you work for companies that have, like, HR staff? Like, would your HR person be comfortable asking? That is actually something that we're working through with the employer pool, is are employers comfortable asking their employees if they're on public assistance? Right? And are employees comfortable telling their employers? Or do we need a third party to facilitate that conversation? And again, that's something we're walking through. Like, do you generally think your HR staff would be comfortable, and your employees would be comfortable having that conversation?
Donna Lee Lozo, I would just say that we hire a fair amount of the people we serve become our staff. Yeah. And they oftentimes voluntarily tell you, you know, what they're on or what they need. Back in the day, my husband and I owned restaurants, and it would always surprised me when people would come in and say, can you pay us under the table because we don't want anybody to know because then I'm going to lose, you know what I mean? So I think people will voluntarily tell you things if they think that you're going to help them have the tools to succeed.
Shannon Reagan, sorry, I would also say that I don't know if our HR staff would be comfortable asking in every case, but I think having some type of a message, some type of messaging saying, are you concerned about losing public benefits by virtue of taking a job at a particular income, would open that conversation if the onboarding employee was interested in having it, right?
So, Ori Lundergan, so I have kind of a different, I have a very similar view. I'm a business here in Concord, and I know that my employees are very open about what they can and can't do, because we try to hire those as disabilities. So we're very having these conversations of what are you on, you know, what can we do, where is that with? So we have that. Us work full time for a business based out of Manchester, and our HR department does that exact thing. They put up a survey, but they more or less put out messaging saying, hey, are you concerned with this new merit conversation we're having that you're going to be impacted? Well, here's a cost calculator. Come to us. We'll walk you through. We'll help. So I think the messaging from the HR department is really important. I think on the onboarding or hiring on a small business, this is a small business versus large business. Small business, it's much easier to have those conversations when you're bringing somebody on board. That, you know, this is what it is. Are you concerned? Is there something else we can do to support you?
So Jim Alden again. We're talking about how the employer interacts with an employee on this. In looking at the participation rate so long, to me the question is how do we get the message out to the people that are on the sidelines that aren't, that are not participating? We're talking about somebody who's already been shot in the community and job. But there's a bunch of folks on the sideline. How do we get that message out to them? Get back to the game.
That is a great question. I got a good point. I mean, honestly, I just...
Yeah.
I just I used to be in that world so much, and I think when the Fed focused mostly for this full appointment, but I would just be a better sense of like who is that job? Is it child care? Which I think was, a big deal, particularly until very recently. And it's just not entirely clear, like, is this, part of that long-term train? Is it something that is very specific to the pandemic? I know we just have to have a better grasp of, like, who is still sitting on the sidelines and why are. And there may be 10 reasons why, and this would address part of that.
But, Chris Santino, but partnering with those organizations that support people that may be sitting on the sidelines and developing some of those partnerships, like, I know all the time, we hear from, long-term care, home health, like all these organizations, we need employees, and I'm always saying, talk with Donnelly, talk with Kim and her staff, because we have people, it's just finding that right niche for them. And I also think for employers, looking at what are ways that they can assist their employees without payment. So, like, child care is a huge issue, right? Because I also have child care under some of my areas. And, how can businesses partner with local child care providers to ensure that there's, space available and cover some of those pieces so that their employees have child care. So thinking of different ways to partner.
Donnelly, again, I'm just, I am sensitive to the time, but I think one of the things that's important to understand about today's presentation is three tools that we're talking about. The first two are really about the people on the sidelines. How do we help them? The last tool that's being refined is about how does an employer, once they're in there and you want them to move up and fill other positions or take on more hours, what can you do? So I think all three of them together can really make a difference. And what we've learned from Commissioner Kapatis and a lot of the work that's done here is you have the early retirement group, you have the young people whose student debt doesn't have to be paid right now, so they're kind of sitting on the sidelines figuring things out, getting them back in the workforce. Those on Social Security that, maybe have decided, I'm a little bored, what do I do? So I think there's some opportunity, and, having the opportunity to present here today so that you can see some of this work that's being done collectively and collaboratively, I think was important for and good timing for where we are today.
Thank you very much. This is something that I appreciate having me here. And like I said, we are not actively deploying. We're actually going through this pilot on the employer tool right now, but we do have these other tools. I am more than happy. I think the last slide has my email address, but I can ask a card. If anybody is interested in this, please reach out if anybody wants a demonstration of some of these other tools. Myself or some of my colleagues are more than happy to schedule time to walk through them in greater detail. But again, thank you very much.
Do I need to say something?
I'm just calling. I have 2 days from the
Okay,
so
I say that to you?
Yes, please.
Would you take us through item 2B?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great.
For the record, Joe Dorian, just want to acknowledge real fast, your name, sir?
Ashok
Patel. And Chairman Kane joined us during the presentation, just noting for attendance for the record. Item 2B on page 49 of your packets. And again, with information noted from new board members as well, we had some folks joined the board recently. I know Candace Hyde, replacing Tamer Cofield, has taken a new position elsewhere within the Job Corps system. And Cindy Harrington joining us after Tina Kasem took a job outside of state government. So the board has added some new folks. So for informational items, the information provided will provide some context as staff, but if you have questions, please feel free to ask. Item 2B is talking about, we kind of had a different plan for how the summer was going to turn out. Ask us after the meeting about what we've called this past summer. It's kind of funny. We had magnets made, but we had our job match system go down. We're part of a nationwide. We're in good company. the entire job match system provided by Geographic Solutions was down. We were working with our sub-recipients to get that up. Our case management system provides us the opportunity to work with clients from intaking of applications to supportive documents to following up to ensuring that items are paid for. So with kind of the big system, how we've moved away in government from paper and pen to having our one system go down was not great. And we're happy that we didn't tear out all of our hair, which is great. But you can kind of see the actions we took, the outcome. Just want to do a huge shout out to some staff at New Hampshire Employment Security, especially Sarah Morrissey, Dee Skinner, and Melinda Antonowicz.
Yeah.
Antonowicz. I was just calling Melinda, working with us around the clock, after hours, on the weekends. We are currently working on our program year 2022 backlog with our sub-recipients. And if you notice that this meeting is a little lighter than normal, if you've been on the board for a number of years, our October meeting agenda is usually a little bit more robust, so I think we'll end a little early today, but I do apologize for the February meeting in advance. Sorry. So we'll see you all there. But happy to entertain Mr. Chairman if there are any questions.
Right. If anyone has a question, you can raise your hand.
May I go item 2C?
Please.
And Mr. Chairman, Jimmy Hinson has, so we're on page 50 and 51, and Jimmy Hinson will take it from here.
Hello, I'm Jimmy Hinson. I'm the State of New Hampshire Dislocated Worker Administrator. The first report I'm going to cover is the end of the year report for rapid response. We ended the July 1st, 2021 through June 30th, 2022, documenting 14 rapid response activities that affected 784 workers. This was an actual noticeable drop from the previous year. Last year, we had 25 total rapid responses that affected 1,164 workers. Very happy to say that out of the 784 people who were laid off, 427 actually came to an in-person rapid response session. You may notice there's a significant difference in numbers. We move very quickly to help people get reemployed. And sometimes the goal is to get them employed before they're laid off, and that's where that sometimes happens. In this market right now, that's not hard to do, find good places for good workers. As we transition into this year, we're seeing a shift out of the virtual completely into the in-person responses. So we're happy to see that happening. We're continuing to work with Cindy Harrington and her team, the Division of Economic Development, training the facilitators that work out in the field to facilitate a lot of these responses. And that's all I have for the end of the year report. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to entertain them.
Thank you.
Okay. Item 2C1, do you mind, Jimmy, taking from there?
Yeah, this is the actual update for this year. From the July 1st to present, we are starting to see a small uptick in rapid response from the previous year. At the time of this report, written a little over 2 weeks ago, we had 6 rapid response activities across the state, which was actually 3 more at the same time the previous year. These 6 affected 307 workers, and they impacted the areas of logistics, retail, manufacturing, and hospitality. The purpose, the reason I said that at the time of the report, since the time of the report, we've also had notification of 4 additional rapid responses. One, we learned of an environmental company out in the Milford area that just closed due to lack of work. We were very fortunate to be able to take all 47 of those employees and move those to other industry openings in the immediate area. So there was really no need to do a rapid response there. The other one is we had a business, HCP Packaging, just did a reorganization, basically laid off 15 people from there, continuing to do their operations. One of the most recent ones, Textile Coated International, out of Manchester, we were working with them to do what we call a work share program, where we keep people employed while they have a reduced number of hours, and that seemed to be a good fit for the business. However, a lot of the employees were not happy about the reduction in hours, and a significant number of them offered to be laid off as a result of that. The final number that we did find out yesterday is a total of 30 people have been laid off of that company, and we are currently talking with the HR manager, making sure that they understand all the different programs and services that we have to offer. And the final one that just hit the news last night, Project Mountain, is going to be closing here in New Hampshire, and that's going to affect 100 employees, as well as a full-time, 18 part-time, and approximately 50 students that actually live on campus. So we're still in the process of finding out all the details on that, and we're working on that, and I'll send out a report to the management as soon as I have all the details. We are planning to roll out a full rapid response team for them, as well as offer a potential job fair on site. And that concludes the up-to-date. If you have any questions, I'll be able to answer those as well.
Thank you. Should we move on to 2D?
Yeah. Item 2D is going to be talking about numbers, and at the June meeting, I had mentioned again how our summer was going a totally different direction. Laura Kane, who was with the office for a number of years.
Can I add one more thing?
Sure,
quick, if
sure.
You don't mind. I think sometimes I get these reports and they're just so basic and so harsh. A lot of people don't understand the real true impact of what can happen. And up in Colebrook, we had American Polymer had a closure in which it affected several hundred, about 150 employees. We did a full rapid response in the town of Colebrook, and as a result, we were able to find quite a few people jobs during that time period. The coordination within the NH Works office, led by Diana up there and empowered with Sarah Morrison, really did help us pull a team together. We ended up having 39 people actually attend the in-person rapid response. That led to 3 vocational rehabilitation New Hampshire referrals. It led to 39 direct contacts with a community action agency providing direct services. We had 50 people attend the job fair, so we actually had people come off the street to attend the job fair. 10 people actually signed up for health care through the HHS, which we later learned that most of these people did not have access to cell phone or computer. So it was good that we had staff on board. And I think one of the other things that this led to that was pretty amazing was direct contact with 4 other businesses so that they could hire our individuals and set up a pipeline type of training that included pre-apprentices, training through our WIOA dislocated worker program, and pipeline training that also included apprenticeships. So it's really an incredible opportunity when you're able to witness a town who's really taken it hard, but also appreciate the true work that our team does in the field. And I just want to extend, you know, an appreciation for all of our NH Works partners to making this and all of the rapid responses this year a huge success.
Just a quick question, George Capatis, for the record. How many people there altogether? 180? Was that what the number
was? Around 180. In fact, the Community Action Program, the Tri-County CAP, just had a mobile van show up for a week, in which we've actually been reported that they actually hired several people from that group. And a lot of people have been picked up in other different businesses. The job fair helped make a lot of the placements. How many, it's hard to tell, but you can kind of get a look, as you well know, by just looking at the unemployment numbers. they're not as high as the 180, which is good. Thank you, and I apologize for interrupting.
No worries. And Jimmy did a great job, too, with that. And it was a team effort, but Jimmy did a really, really good job coordinating all that. So again, 2D, financial summary. I was mentioning, you know, that last June meeting, Laura LaCane left our office. We're happy to welcome Nora to the team. So just a new face. So please, you know, before leaving today, make sure you get to say hi. And Nora, would you mind taking us through item 2D?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Nora Lokutsa. I'm really happy to be the administrator for OLO. So we're going to just go over our funding. So the LEOA Title I grant has three streams of funding, dislocated worker, adults, and youth. We get one program year, and then it carries forward for two additional years. So a total of 3 years to spend down all our funds. So as you can see here, though, we have four program years open. So for program 19, we actually got an extension for that to spend down the discretionary funds. And at this time, we have obligated with a new contract to spend on the rest of those discretionary funds, and that should be completed probably within quarter two or quarter three. And our extension is for June of 2023, so we'll definitely meet that deadline. And then for program year 20, we have expended about 81%, and for program year 21, we're at 22%. And 22, we just voted on that in the last SWIB meeting, and right now we haven't extended anything, but once program year 20 is spent down a little bit more, it will we'll probably start in quarter two doing a little bit more in program year 22. The other two things I want to mention, I kind of mentioned about discretionary funds. We have two contracts that were recently awarded. One for a statewide evaluation, and one to return to community. These are both, are getting, all the funds are through the discretionary funds. So this will help spend down all of Q119, as mentioned before, but also it will spend down about half of Q120. So we'll be on track for that. One other thing too is we did see a big increase in funding in PY21, and this was due to COVID. So it was about $1 million increase. For PY22, we did see an increase too, and this was also due to COVID funding. So that was probably an additional $300,000. But by program year 23, it'll probably be back. We are a minimally funded state, which is done by a formula. So it'll probably go back to that formula in PY23. But if anybody has any questions, feel free to ask.
We're doing that good.
Yeah.
Joe, question. Justin Campbell. With the discretionary funds, is there any limitation to where that money, since it seems to be lagging, is there any limitation to where that money could be expelled for?
Yep, so we, and I'll let Nora, and we have in some of the stuff in the packet. We'll be talking about some of that in 3B. And I think another item, but so we were delayed on getting those dollars out the door due to COVID. So it's a 3 year cycle of dollars. We were wrapping up what was called the Sector Partnership Initiative, where that had a time limited amount of funds for what, 5 or 6 years, correct me if I'm wrong, Jimmy. And so that was winding down right when COVID hit and everything shut down. So spend went down considerably across the board in all of our programs because people were closing up and just reacting to the pandemic and not looking to do training and whatnot with the uncertainty. So that's a reflection of the lack of spend due to the COVID shutdown. And then with staff changes, the entire OO staff has basically changed over in the past 3 years, including my predecessor, Jacqueline Huser. So coming in, there's a delay, and then having to then go through our great governor and council process to get contracts out, which takes anywhere between 2 to 5 months, ish, you know, and all that. So kind of the long and short of it, it's just with the immediate shutdown and then kind of getting things up and going again, that's the reason for the delay. In terms of what we can use, we can provide some guidance to you. We don't have that offhand right now, but it's more or less special projects and special initiatives that the board designates or the governor designates and whatnot. So it's much more flexible. It's the most flexible dollars that we have, so we're much more careful with them given... that help? I'm sorry if my coffee kicked in.
No, I'm fine. Okay. I was more wondering if there were limitations, like if there's surplus money, why can't you put that towards running free training classes? Obviously, I'm familiar with the State Fire Academy, but
yep.
Different trades, different businesses across New Hampshire, if we could pay the funding for putting on the training program, then people could attend it.
Yeah. So we can do with... our partners with Employment Security and Southern New Hampshire Services on the adult and dislocated. So what we have to also be careful about is, you know, we have the three funding streams programmatically, youth, adult, and dislocated. And what we don't want to do with the governor's discretionary is kind of supplant the dollars for another program sort of thing. As I mentioned, the discretionary dollars are much more fluid, easily... a lot less rules around them, so we want to, where the funds are more prescriptive on the adult, dislocated, and youth side, specifically for training, specifically for supportive services, we want to target those dollars there to not create a gap elsewhere. That's helpful. Right, and Nora, did I?
No, that's correct, yeah.
Joe Brown, Franklin. Interesting you should bring that up. We had a meeting of our fire committee last night, and one of the things that they were asking about is there a way where the young people coming in who are not CDL certified, and it's about a $4,100
price.
Yeah, ish.
Skyrocket.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, really gone up. Because of where we are in Franklin, our demographics is a little bit less than it is in other areas, opportunity is not as high. That's a big hit for a new person coming on that's not getting a whole lot more than a kind of a fair wage, not even a really good wage. And then to have that, we actually had a situation, I don't know if it was in Franklin, but close by, where a chief had to drive the two firefighters because they were not able and had not gotten through the CDL process. To his question, is any of that discretionary funds available for that kind of thing?
So again, we have existing dollars currently. So part of our eligible training provider list is the New Hampshire Fire Academy for EMS-1. EMS-1, Firefighter-1, Firefighter-2, we have had for a number of years, and those are new programs, and also some private providers of EMS services that we've added with working with the Department of Safety. We've had for a number of years CDL is existing currently, and I love doing waivers. Just approved one this morning for CDL for dislocated worker. So we have CDL courses around the state currently for folks that are eligible. On the municipal side, there is a noticeable gap with, for instance, as Work Invest is structured, because the towns don't pay into unemployment. I was talking to Rich about that, Commissioner, correct me if I'm wrong, where the employers don't pay into that. So there's some the municipalities have communicated some struggles, so we were actually having conversations with, looking at another board member, Cindy Harrington. Teresa was, we were gonna work with the Collaborative Economic Development Regions to have conversations about how do we close the gap with municipalities in terms of funding. So that's something we wanna have conversations on, but our chief champion moved on to the Small Business Administration, so. So what I'm hearing from board members is to look into that a little bit more and report back. Is that...
Yes, please.
Okay.
Great. My goal wasn't anything, Justin Kander, it was anything specific, although the fire world is my whole life. I wasn't thinking it had to be specific to that. I mean, there's probably deficiencies in most trades, small businesses, education, that there's probably training that are desirable that would help lend people into the career path or help people support that are already in their respective career paths. If it could be almost like funds that host the class, pay for the hosting of the class, and it gives people an opportunity to go attend something that maybe would have already had a registration fee, something that they couldn't afford. Maybe they know the means of travel or making the time to get there. But then, you know, I'm not educated in all the hoops
and everything. And again, for the record, Joe Dorian, happy to take, because that's something we were talking about, but again, we're not immune to the workforce shortages as well in state government. We're hovering around a 21-22% unemployment. I'm sorry, vacancy rate, forgive me, 21-22% vacancy rate within the state government. So that's something that we were going to, and then staff departure. So I can definitely follow up with both of you on that after.
Thank you.
Oh, should we go to 2E?
Happy to. So 2E, the updates are found in here, but we had, in previous board meetings, we had to address the lack of spend that I mentioned earlier in the last item, including with discretionary. It affected everybody, youth, discretionary, adult, and dislocated worker. So the VIP effort, the Vibrant, Inclusive, and Prosperous program, is actually used with surplus adult funds, about $1.2 million, where we had money that had not been spent. And again, when the pandemic shut everything down, it shut everything down, and that's hard to turn back on a system, right? It's kind of like a train. It has to kind of get momentum. So we worked with our partners, and we did we created the VIP initiative, which is essentially outreach to historically marginalized communities. The board voted on and approved a while back Southern New Hampshire Services as one of the recipients, but also the International Institute of New England. That's a nonprofit, but they also partner with building communities in New Hampshire. So we have two vendors, IINE, International Institute of New England, and Southern New Hampshire Services. So this is an example, again, of using the unspent dollars and redeploying them quickly to help, one, spend down the money, but to have a measurable impact on the workforce. So we're working with historically marginalized communities, which is defined within the vendors receiving these awards as... IINE and BCINH are working on new Americans and refugees for populations. The program is just getting up and running as the board approved this, June 7th? Jeez, seems like longer. But currently, we're not even done kind of with like the first full quarter of it. But we're looking at 25 enrollments in our adult program as a direct result of this program. There are other referrals that were made, but they didn't translate into enrollments, so maybe they would be covered under another workforce program within the state of New Hampshire. So we'll have more details on that in the future when our job map system is fully back up and running. But happy to kind of answer any questions about that. But the top line is we've had, in a short time, 25 new enrollments in our adult program as a result of this program, and they come from the new Americans and refugee populations here in this state. Happy to take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Great. Should we just keep moving to 2F?
Yep, 2F. You know, we won't go through all the different success stories here, but our partners do take time to gather these success stories, so please, if you haven't read them, please do so. Gives a little background into the type of folks that we serve and the impact that we have. So happy to answer any questions about the success stories if the board has any.
Okay. So are we...
2G.
2G, right?
Yep.
Thank you.
Item 2G comes to us from included in the board packet that went out, but also in the printed materials, is a small slide deck given to us by our partners at New Hampshire Employment Security and the Economic and Labor Market Information Bureau. So in the previous item, we talked about the success stories. But I also kind of want to talk about some of our financial and kind of dollars and cents metrics. For one, for accountability for us, but as taxpayers, it's important for you to know kind of how these programs benefit the New Hampshire economy. So the key takeaway, for every WIOA dollar spent in 2021, the New Hampshire gross domestic product increased by $1.76, which is a pretty darn good rate of return. For every WIOA dollar spent in 2021, yielded $2.95 in total production, including immediate goods and services. And the last top line is, in 2021, 522 jobs were supported by WIOA expenditures. And that is also as a result of kind of low enrollments from COVID. So I think at the end of this program year, I think we're going to smash those numbers. Our partners across the board have really done a great job, as they always do. But the challenge of the immediate COVID pandemic has subsided. Of course, we're dealing with the after effects and whatnot. But we're going to see those numbers jump considerably, which means people put to work here in this great state. But again, you know, the second takeaway, for every $1 yielded $2.95. Pretty darn good. So happy to answer any questions, but I refer you again to the handout that was provided electronically on our website and in person today.
Should we move to three?
Yeah. Great. So item 3A is a request from our partners at DHHS. There's just, I'm going to note a quick typo in this item. So every so often, our friends at New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services have the board kind of provide a blessing, so to speak, of the plan that they put together. The board approved the TANF plan last year. Now we're looking for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, state plan. So DHHS is a valued partner. So we're looking for a draft motion of the State Workforce Innovation Board supports the Bureau of Employment Supports Division of Economics and Housing Stability within the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services SNAP state plan as proposed. Again, we provide this regular sort of support, and staff reviewed it to ensure that the plan is consistent with the SWIB priorities in the New Hampshire Combined State Plan. And I apologize for speaking bureaucrat at you for that entire sentence. Happy to take questions. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Should I? Or should we go to questions?
That's okay. We can just go to questions.
Okay, great.
Yeah. We're on a roll.
No questions. God, you were clear.
I guess I'm getting good at this.
You're getting good. You're getting good.
But, Mr. Chairman, if we could get a motion.
Yes.
And we have a draft motion there, but if we could just omit the TANF, TANF, that would be great.
So moved.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, good.
Item 3B is another item for requiring the board's approval. On August 3rd, 2022, the Office of Workforce Opportunity, on behalf of the State Workforce Innovation Board, solicited an RFP for a Return to Community Strategic Partner Engagement and Study to look at the barriers that justice involves individuals face when trying to re-enter the workforce after release from incarceration. The U.S. Department of Labor defines justice-involved individuals as those currently incarcerated, going through the criminal justice system, or have come out of the criminal justice system, so people that are being released from jail. The board, in previous guidance, directed staff to take a look at innovative strategies to address workforce issues. And identified this population as a population of interest. So what we did was we took a, we put out an RFP to try and take almost like a census of what is currently out there in existing programs. So, you know, Department of Corrections has a number of great programs. Our partners in employment security have a number of really great programs. The community college system is a partner, career and technical education. So kind of taking a look holistically at what's out there, what's working, what isn't working, what are the barriers for justice-involved individuals, but also what's the barrier for employers? You know, what are your barriers in trying to hire these folks or struggles and whatnot? So we put it out to bid and received the bids that you see below. Public Consulting Group, LLC, received the highest score of 94.33 with a bid amount of $167,000 and $167,159. The review committee of the SWIB, consisting of Christine Brennan, Tamer Cokeel, and Tim Sink, scored the RFPs, which we thank them for their time. And we are slated to go before Governor and Executive Council early November. We've had some departures at BEA in our business office, so we were supposed to go sooner, but again, the workforce crisis is affecting us as well. So, Mr. Chairman, we staff has put together a draft motion for the board's consideration.
Great. Do you want to propose that, George? Or no?
Sure. Oh,
you can go to
this one.
You can do this one? Okay. So I propose that we approve the draft motion, approve the return to community strategic partner engagement and study award to the Public Consulting Group, LLC, in the amount of $167,159.00.
I'll second. Donnelly Mosel.
Thank you.
It's a tough name.
All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Great. Let's go to 3C.
And giving you all a break from hearing my voice, I'm going to kick it over to Nora.
Okay, so now we're going to look more in depth into that program year 2022. So the total funding we received was $7,319,128. This is split up to youth, adults, and associate workers. The big thing about these funds is we were awarded in April and went to June, and after 3 years to extend it. And then for the associate worker and adults, we were awarded in July and then June, and then the 3 years to finish it. For the adult and associate worker to be seen on the master budget, there's two rounds of funding, one that's funded in July, and then the other one that's funded right now in October. So you can see that split up into what we're awarded now and what we'll be awarded this month for the total amount. The biggest thing is the requirements for expending the funds. 90% has to be programmed, and 10% will be administration. By the end of June, we have to have 80% obligated, which has already happened for all three programs. So that has already been obligated. And as you can see on the state formula fund, for the youth, adult, and dislocated worker program, you can see who we obligated to. So for youth, we have the JAG program, My Turn. So they have the $1,832,899. And then for adults and dislocated workers, that is NHS that is awarded to. So what we are motioning is to the proposed VOA Title I program year 2022 budget that is submitted right here. But of course, we can make some questions before we do that. Yeah.
Yes, sorry.
Thank you. Representative Alexander for the record. What is the, I know that the cap is 10% for administration. What historically has been the percentage that we've used the grant for administration?
We usually do the full 10.
You go right up to 10?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes.
This is on page
74.
Sorry. Your turn, George. I'd move that we approve the proposed WIOA Title I PY 2022 budget as submitted by staff. Thank you, Nora.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Can we just get clarification on who the second was?
I second it.
Okay.
I think someone else did too. Joe Brown, second.
You're enough for me. That's good.
This one I should probably abstain on because we've got an adult in this.
If you'd like.
I actually had, Donnelly Rosal, I had mentioned to Joe when I came in the question about abstaining because we're a recipient.
Right.
But it seems like this is just the money coming into the state, not necessarily who it's dispersed to, but it's probably not a bad
thing. Yeah, I think I'm just, yeah.
Okay, so myself and the commissioner are in good company abstaining.
Yeah. Is this, are we going to 3C now? Is that bad?
And so for the record, Mayor Joe Brown seconded, and we have abstentions from Commissioner Kapatos and Donald Lozo.
Correct.
And we've gotten the all in favor, right?
Yep.
And no one opposed.
Correct.
Great, so we're good.
it saves us, I'm trying to save money, so when we say our names, it saves money with the transcription service. So it's funny because they're going to hear that and go, yep, yes it does. Because I hear everything. Item 3D, real fast, we put a bright kind of Halloween fall paper, yellowy orange. We've been very fortunate for the last number of meetings to be hosted here by New Hampshire Employment Security. As the state continues to open up and more in-person services happen, which we all love to see, these rooms are used to work with different clients that come in for a lot of our programs, but a whole lot of other programs that Employment Security offers. So we had to find some new places to meet. So for the next calendar year, so you can, of course, always come here. It's a public building, but we won't be here. So if you notice, the board voted at the last meeting for the next three meetings, which is February 7th, 2023, June 6th, 2023, and October 17th of 2023. And we will be at all the next calendar year, so picking up in February and going to June and October, we will be at the New Hampshire Audubon Society on 84 Silk Farm Road, Concord, New Hampshire, 03301. So you'll receive emails from Melissa or myself to remind you, because I know kind of, you know, muscle memory driving over here, but there's plenty of parking, plenty of space. So we're looking forward to seeing you at a different location, but for the same meeting. All of our meetings are publicly noticed on the New Hampshire Works website to be compliant with RSA 91A, including with the transcription services. So again, please note this, just so we can start promptly on time for February 7th, because it's going to be a very busy meeting. Any questions I can answer for you about that? So we'll be there. Item 3D and 3E, Mr. Chairman, serve as an opportunity if the board would like to add anything, to talk about anything, or provide anything for the February agenda. I will say that due to the JMS system being down and a few other, how that pushes back, we're going to have quite a busy meeting on February 7th. So I just want to be cautious of everyone's time. But happy to answer any questions about 3D or 3E.
So you're telling us that the February meeting is going to be a slog?
Yes.
And you want to know if anyone wants to make it longer?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, who wants to scrub the February meeting? All right. I think everyone's pretty much in line with you on this one.
Okay. So all we have, Mr. Chairman.
Great. So what do you want to do next?
We have a motion to adjourn and then a closing, if you don't mind reading, so we can...
I'll read all of this.
So moved.
Okay. I like her. Again, for the record, this is Michael Kane. I would like to thank the members of the board for their participation and attendance today, even though I was late. Our presenters and staff for putting this meeting together. This concludes the duly noticed meeting for the State Workforce Innovation Board. This meeting has been recorded and was conducted in a manner compliant with RSA 91-A. Thank you to the members of the public for joining this duly noticed meeting of the State Workforce Innovation Board. Please end the recording. And then could we get the time?
Yeah, 2:35, and we have a motion to adjourn.
Joe Brown.
Do we have a second?
I'll second. Or, no, wait, who said? Who wanted to second? You second. You second. Which one
seems
of you guys?
Seems to be unanimous.
This is good. Let's go with the state rep. Okay. All in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Okay, good. Thank you, guys. And sorry I was late.
Good to see you.
That was good.
Lots of comedy.